Okay, we'll start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Now I have four eyes. Two mouths. If I had hearing aids in both ears, I would have four ears. And then all I would need would be the nose to help me smell, and all of my sense faculties would be duplicated. Okay, today we are taking the Seika Sutta. This is the disciple and higher training. Now, I have to apologize for missing the class last week, even though I said I would be present. But last Friday, Venerable Kemaratana and we went on a very long walk down Manhattan just for the exercise, the fun of it. Started from 125th Street, and we walked all the way down to Wall Street. And we even took our arms bowls along, and we went on arms round between 79th Street and 70th Street. And we really got the ultimate arms offering. You know, they say in Buddhism that emptiness is the key to liberation. So we both finished up our arms round with a bowl full of emptiness. But we had our friend Chris Raines along, who treated us to lunch. Okay, so after that long walk, it was a sunny day, the temperature was in the early, the low 70s, and I thought walking out in the sun was very pleasant. So I didn't bring a cap along, and didn't even want to walk on the shady side of the street. When I got back to the monastery, even that night I didn't feel it, but it was the next morning after waking up. My face was red, head was red. I felt really just literally burned out. Because being exposed to the sun for 6 hours continuously, it builds up a cumulative force that one doesn't feel in any particular moment, but after 6 hours of that bombardment with sun rays, it gets into the body, and I just felt my whole body burning and exhausted. But I heard that Venerable Kemaratana gave a very nice, inspiring and uplifting account of the walk. Okay, so now we come to the Seika Sutta. Okay, so this sutta begins when the Buddha is living in his own native land. This is the Sakya country, because the Buddha came from the Sakya Republic, which had its capital in the city of Kapilavastu. In Sanskrit, Kapilavastu. Okay, so at this time, the Sakyans had recently finished building a new assembly hall. You see, the Sakyans were a republic. Well, they weren't a monarchy. And so sometimes it's said that the Buddha was the son of a very powerful king, That's really legend, not historical fact. The Sakyans had a republican type of government. I mean, a republic, let's say a republic, not a republican type of government. And it seems that the country was ruled by a number of aristocratic families together who constituted a kind of council. And so presumably this assembly hall was the place where the ruling elite would meet in order to discuss matters of government. Okay, and so at this point, when the sutta takes place, the assembly hall has just been, the construction of it has just been completed, but it has not yet been used. It hasn't been inhabited by anybody else. And now this is a custom that probably goes from this because it goes back to the time of the Buddha, but it is also still a living custom in some Buddhist countries that when devout Buddhist people say if they build a house for themselves, before they actually move in and occupy the house themselves, they will invite maybe a group of monks or a prominent monk to come and at least spend one night in it. They feel that this brings a kind of blessing power to the new house. We call this like mangala. Mangala means something like blessing. This is the Chinese ji xiang, right? Or is it ji xiang? Which one? Two second tones. Both second tones. So, ji xiang. Okay, so in this case, before the Sakyans actually used this assembly hall, they wanted their eminent kinsmen, the Buddha and the Sangha, to use it. And so they invited the Buddha, they came to the Buddha. The Buddha at that time was living a little bit outside the city, in a park that belonged to the Shakya named Nigrodha. So they came to the Buddha and invited him to come and use the assembly hall first. Then after that, the Sakyans themselves would make use to it. And so they say at the end of the invitation, they say, when you have used it first, afterwards, we, the Sakyans of Kapilavastu, will use it, and that will lead to our welfare and happiness for a long time. Actually, if you know anything about the history of early Buddhism, the Sakyans actually didn't have welfare and happiness for a long time. But they were actually subjected to almost a complete massacre late in the life of the Buddha, which brought about virtually the complete decimation or extinction of the Sakyan clan. This happened because the king of the state of Kosala, whose name was King Vitudava. Vitudava. Had a grudge against the Sakyans, and he brought his army to the Sakyan Republic and killed, massacred almost all the Sakyans. Does anybody know why King Vitudava had this grudge against the Sakyans? Okay, but maybe I should tell it because I have the microphone, the amplifier. You see, King Kosala, the king vicinity of Kosala, served as a kind of protector of the Sakyans, even though the Sakyans were a republic, but King Pasenadi of Kosala was a very powerful king. And so he wanted to establish a kind of alliance, an alliance with the Sakyans. And the way for him to do this was to ask the Sakyans to send a Sakyan woman, a young Sakyan woman, to the state of Kosala to become the wife of King Pasenadi. But the Sakyans were a very proud people, and they didn't want to send a purebred Sakyan woman to Kosala to become the wife of King Pasenadi. So what they did was to send a servant woman, maybe she was actually a slave woman, to King Pasenadi, and she became his wife. And King Pasenadi didn't know that she was a slave woman. He thought that she was from the Sakyan aristocracy. So he married her, and the offspring of that marriage was King Vidudeva. And he thought that he was the offspring of his own father, the king, and of an aristocratic Sakyan woman. But one time, King Vidudeva went to visit the Sakyans, and the Sakyans showed him, externally, they showed him all due respect that they were obliged to show to a powerful king. But as they were leaving, as the king and his entourage were leaving, the king remembered that he had forgotten something. He left something behind in the hall where he was meeting the Sakyans. And so he sent one of his servants into the hall to retrieve that item that he had left behind. Could have been his weapon or a hat, I don't remember what it is. But when the servant came into the hall, he heard the Sakyans, who were cleaning up the hall, mumbling and grumbling and saying, "That king is so proud, but he's just the offspring of a slave woman." And the servant of the king overheard this and reported it to the king. And the king made some inquiries and found out that his own father had been deceived by the Sakyans. And he said, "I'm going to get my revenge on them." And so when the time was right, he got his army together, and he traveled again to the Sakyan Republic, fully armed army, with the intention of obliterating the Sakyans. And he said, "I'm going to wash the soil of their land with their own blood." And the Buddha knew what was going to happen. So the Buddha went to the Sakyan Republic, and he sat along the road leading from Kosala to Kapilavastu, the Sakyan capital. He sat under a tree, and as the army was proceeding, they saw the Buddha sitting there under the tree. And the kings came to him and said, "Why are you sitting under this tree with just very few leaves?" So it was really hot, and there was almost no shade from that tree. And the Buddha said that if you obliterate my kinsmen so that only a few will be left, my family will be like this tree, which just has a few leaves left. So when the Buddha said that, the king and his army turned around and went back to Savatthi. But after a little time, they decided to invade again. So again they came up, again the Buddha sat under the tree, and again he discouraged them from attacking the Sakyan capital. A third time they came, third time the Buddha tried to discourage them, the third time they turned back and went to their home. But a fourth time, they decided to attack the capital. And this time the Buddha realized that somehow that there was some negative karma of the Sakyans from some previous life that could not be negated, that could not be counteracted. So the Buddha knew that any effort on his part was futile. And so he didn't try to discourage the king a fourth time. And the king and the army came and they killed so many of the Sakyans. Only a small number were able to escape. And the rest were just obliterated. So that is the fate of the Buddha's own family. Okay, so continuing, coming back to the sutta. So the Sakyans invite the Buddha to come to the assembly hall to use it first. The Buddha accepts in silence. Okay, then the Sakyans, when they receive the Buddha's consent, they go back to the assembly hall and they prepare it, decorating it for the arrival of the Buddha. They cover it with tasteful coverings. They prepare all the seats for the Buddha and the Sangha. And they put out a large water jug and they hang up oil lamps. Okay, then they come back to the Buddha and they tell him that the assembly hall has been completely prepared and you can come at your own convenience. Okay, so the Buddha puts on his robes, all of his robes, takes his bowl and his outer robe, and then together with the community of monks, he goes to the assembly hall. So you can imagine this with your mind's eye, that the Buddha is walking along the road, followed by the monks, walking very stately, dignified way, and with so many great, accomplished monks behind him, all very serene, restrained, mindful, clearly comprehending. Okay, then they arrive. Since they're walking barefoot along the dusty road, they wash their feet, and then they enter the hall. And when they enter, this is interesting, the arrangement. There's a central pillar in the hall. We don't have a pillar here, but in those days they had to use a central pillar to serve as a support for the other, what do you call these? What are these called?
Arches,
okay. So the central pillar holds up the arches, and the Buddha comes, and he sits down in front of the central pillar, facing the east. Then all of the monks come, they wash their feet, they enter the hall, and they sit down along the western wall, also facing the east, so that the Buddha is in front of the monks, and all of the monks are against the back wall behind the Buddha. And then the Sakyans, the people of the Sakyan clan, they enter the hall, wash their feet, enter the hall, and they sit down against the eastern wall facing the west. So the Buddha has his back to the monks, his face to the Sakyans, and the Buddha is in the center of the hall. Okay, then, this is the evening, so the Buddha starts to give the Sakyans a Dharma talk, and he speaks maybe for a few hours, but then the Buddha starts to get tired, and he says that his back is hurting or feeling uncomfortable. Do you know why the Buddha's back was causing him pain? This we see in quite a few suttas that the Buddha, after he's talking for several hours, he starts to feel pain in the back. And he'll ask one of the other monks to take over. And he says, I have to lie down. Any ideas? Okay, it's a little... If you haven't heard the explanation, then you might not know it. But it's because when the Buddha was still seeking enlightenment, he practiced these austere practices for 6 years. So as a result of those austere practices, self-mortification, self-starvation, sleeping on beds of thorns, going naked during the cold season, the winter, exposing himself to the heat of the sun, putting myself during the hot season. So he sort of weakened his bodily strength. And as a result of that, he developed this tendency towards back pain in his later years. And so, at this time, the Buddha asks Ananda to take over. And there was a special reason why the Buddha asked Ananda to take over. What is that reason?
I believe that Ananda, Venerable Ananda, had a very photographic memory of all the discourses that he used to give. And one of the conditions he had imposed on Buddha was that any time he was out and any discourse was given,
yeah,
it would be given to him. So he had heard everything before.
Okay, this is a good reason, but maybe... Okay, so the explanation he gives is that Ananda had a very excellent memory, so that he could, firstly, a photographic memory, so that he could remember all the discourses that he had heard from the Buddha or from the monks. Maybe that's one reason, but there's another reason as well. Where does Ananda come from?
Well, he was Shakya too.
That's right, yeah, because Ananda was also a Shakya. So probably the Buddha wants to make the Shakyans pleased. And so he asks, you know, he has Sariputta, Moggallana, probably along with him. But he asks Ananda to speak to the Shakyans, because the Shakyans are a bit of a proud people. And so they want to have one of our boys giving the talk, presumably. And so the Buddha asks Ananda to speak. Maybe we call this like skillful means. But the Buddha gives the topic to Ananda. So he says, Ananda, speak to the Shakyans about the disciple in higher training who has entered upon the way. Okay, here we have two terms with something of a technical meaning. Yeah, in Pali, the terms are Sekha Patipatta. Now the word Seka is a technical term which means a disciple who has reached, you say, direct comprehension of the truth of the Dhamma. One who has achieved what we call sometimes the Abhisamaya, that means the breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma, or one who has gained Dhammacakku, the eye of the Dhamma, with which one sees the truth of the teaching. And this is also called a stream enterer, Sotapanna, one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma. And so the level of Seka begins with entering the way to stream entry. And it includes those disciples of the next two higher stages, the once returner who comes back to this sensual realm, either the human realm or the heavenly realms, one more time, and then reaches final liberation, or the non-returner who doesn't come back to the sensual realm but takes rebirth in one of the higher realms and there reaches final liberation. But the Sangha has not yet finished cultivating the path. The one who has finished cultivating the path is the Arahat, the one who has gained full realization of the Dhamma, the one who has fully eradicated all the defilements. And so the Sangha is called Patipatta, which means one on the way, one on the path, or one engaged with the practice who is bound to reach full realization without ever falling back to the level of an ordinary, unenlightened person. Okay, so now in this sutta, Ananda is going to speak about the special qualities of the Sangha, the one in training, that enables him or her to progress from the stage of a Sangha, one in training, to the stage of an Arahant. And the Arahant is called, sometimes in the text, Asaya, which literally it means a non-trainer or non-trainee, but not a non-trainee the way people like me are, you know. You know, you have a choice between meditating and watching the TV, you watch the TV. Or if you feel a little tired, you take a nap. But it's the non-trainee in the sense of the one who's finished with the training. One who has completed the training. So there's no more training to undertake because he's, you would say, the one who's perfected the training. Okay, so now the Buddha gives this instruction to Ananda, and then he prepares his what's called the patchwork cloak. It's the double robe. He folds it in four. He lays down on his right side in what is called the lion's pose. Because the lion, when it sleeps, it has a kind of dignified posture. That is, the lion puts one leg over the other and presumably is mindful and fully aware after noting in his mind the time for rising. So in other words, the Buddha doesn't just lie down and drift off to sleep, but even though he's lying down, it's probably late at night, but he keeps his mindfulness and full awareness of clear comprehension, and he notes that after he's maybe laid down for 20 minutes, 30 minutes to relax the back, then it will get up and listen to the rest of the discourse. Now when the Buddha does that, now Bhikkhu Bodhi is in that audience and he thinks, if the Buddha can do it, I can do it too. So he takes his double robe, spreads it out, lies down in the lion's posture. And then 5 minutes later, everybody is disturbed by a and the Buddha gets up with a stern look on his face and says, Bodhi, get up. So then I have to get up, sit up, and think, why can he do it, but I can't? Okay, so now Venerable Ananda starts to speak. And when he starts to speaking, he specifically sort of addresses the leader of the Sakyans, the elder of the Sakyans, whose name is Mahanama. Okay, and first Ananda gives, this is the typical way, just like the Buddha himself usually teaches, he gives a compressed teaching, that is, he gives a kind of outline of the main points. Then he's going to expand upon them one by one, and then he's going to sum them all up at the end. So this is the outline. First, the noble disciple is possessed of virtue, or in other words, he observes the precepts or the training rules. He guards the doors of his sense faculties. He is moderate in eating. He is devoted to wakefulness. He possesses 7 good qualities that will be elaborated later. And he gains, without trouble or difficulty, the 4 higher meditative states called the 4 jhanas. Okay, so now that is the outline, the steps of the training that the trainee is going to follow. And now Ananda is going to explain them. And he's explaining with reference to a monastic disciple. Even though a sangha doesn't have to be a monastic, there are lay people who are sanghas and monks and nuns who are sanghas. But Ananda is explaining specifically with regard to a monastic disciple. Because even when a lay disciple is practicing earnestly, he or she is trying to, practice in the way that a monastic person does. Okay, so how is the noble disciple possessed of virtue, or virtuous behavior, good behavior? Then Ananda explains, here a noble disciple is virtuous. He dwells restrained by the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha is the code of monastic rules, which the monastic rules were laid down by the Buddha on different occasions, but altogether they constitute a particular code for the observance of monks and nuns. And he is perfect in conduct and resort. Maybe that's a little too strong. the word perfect, but we say he is possessed of good conduct and the proper resort, we can say proper manners. Maybe that's clearer. And seeing fear or danger in the slightest faults, he trains by conforming to the training precepts. So this is how the noble disciple is possessed of virtue. And if you want to see a more elaborate account of the kind of rules that the disciple in training will follow according to the sutta method, you can look in sutta number 27, or maybe closer, sutta 51. From paragraphs 14 actually it's paragraph 14 but it's quite a long paragraph. So those are like the principal rules of training followed by the monastic person. I'm not going to go over them, but just for your own information, you could look at them later. Okay, so this is the foundation of the practice, you could say, the foundation of the training, to observe these training rules which inculcate good conduct of body, speech, and right livelihood. Okay, next comes the restraint of the senses. Now, the next few steps in the training are going to involve what I call an internalization of the process of training, moving from simply good conduct by body and speech into the discipline or training of the mind. And so what forms the starting point for training the mind is especially aiming at, you say, building up the inner qualities needed to achieve deep states of meditation, to achieve deep samadhi or concentration. So what is necessary here is restraint of the senses, or guarding the doors of the sense faculties. And so Ananda explains that when the disciple sees a form with the eye, or hears sounds with the ears, smells a fragrance with the nose, tastes flavors with the tongue, feels some kind of sensation or contact with the body, and cognizes some idea with the mind, he does not grasp at its signs and features. To grasp the signs and features means that when one encounters something which is pleasant and agreeable or attractive, one grasps mentally the appearance and thinks, that is nice. That is lovely. That is attractive. If it's something beautiful, like attractive. So one thinks in that way and one grasps upon that appearance. And then when one grasps upon the appearance with the mind, then that gives the opportunity, usually for states of craving or lust to arise. And if it's something disagreeable or unpleasant, then one grasps the sign or grasps the appearance and one thinks, that's ugly, that's repulsive, and then that's offensive. offensive to me. And then states of aversion or dislike arise. So that is grasping the sign. And then, once one grasps the sign, if one is not mindful and attentive, then one starts looking at the details. Usually, I have to say this is stated with reference to, especially for a monk, a young monk in training, sexual attraction. So if he encounters a pretty girl, a beautiful woman, first he'll grasp the appearance. Ah, he'll grasp the sign. Beautiful girl. Then start looking at the details or the features. Bright, shiny eyes, sweet smile, nice arms, nice breasts, nice feet, nice way of walking. And so that's grasping the details or the features. And if it's something repulsive, you know, usually sometimes the mind doesn't just turn away from it, but, you know, say if somebody speaks aggressively to you, you don't just think he's speaking aggressive words, but you start focusing on the expression on his face. Oh, his mouth was so ugly. His tone was so sarcastic. The way he raised his arms, just like he was going to hit me. And so it starts grasping all these details, and then ill will arises and becomes stronger. Okay, but the way the disciple trains, it's not that he closes the eyes and blocks the ears, but he has to use the senses to get around, but doesn't grasp the signs or the features. And how is this done? What is the, plays the key role here? What kind of mental function? Say it again.
Mindfulness.
Exactly, it's mindfulness. So mindfulness comes in and has that role of being able to note what appears, but not allowing the unwholesome mental states of clinging or grasping and aversion to arise. Because the text goes on to say, since if you left the eye faculty unguarded, bad, unwholesome states or mental states of craving and aversion. I think those are better than covetousness and grief. Of craving and aversion might flow into him. So to avoid that, he practices restraint. He guards the eye faculty and he restrains the eye faculty. And so with the other sense faculties. Okay, the next quality to be developed in paragraph 9, this is called moderation in eating. Let me just put these Pali terms on the board. First, the restraint of the sense faculties. First, we have sila, which is virtue. Two is third is called Bhojane Mutta, which means literally knowing the right amount when eating. You know, during the Buddha's time, it was customary for the ascetics to undertake these extreme ways of dealing with food. So because there's so much attachment and imagination comes up in regard to food, they would think that the way to overcome that craving for food is to reduce the intake of food little by little until you just taking maybe one handful of rice a day with a little sauce on it, and maybe you're going below that to just taking like one spoon of rice with a little pinch of flavor in it per day. But in another sutta, the Buddha speaks a little bit satirically about these ascetics who do this maybe for 3 or 4 months, then when they go off their long fast, then they go on stuffing themselves until they become plump again. And so the Buddha abolished that kind of practice, or rejected that kind of practice of extreme asceticism, and he encourages the disciples to take enough food to sustain their health and strength, but to know the right amount, not to eat to excess, but to take the amount of food that one needs just to keep the body strong and healthy. And so he says, here, reflecting wisely, the noble disciple takes the food not for amusement, not for intoxication with the flavors. Well, I mean, this is a human weakness, but have you ever tried Hispanic food before? No, never had it. Then let's go get Hispanic food. How about Turkish food? There's a new Turkish restaurant down the street. I mean, I like that too. But, you know, when one is training vigorously, you're just content with your tofu and your broccoli and cabbage every day, or if you're in India, your rice or chapatis and your dal, you know, the dal, the lentils, it's curried lentils every day. So you just eat without concern about the flavor, not for the sake of physical beauty, for eating to make oneself beautiful and strong, and to make oneself attractive, but only for the maintenance and continuance of the body, for ending the discomfort of hunger, and for assisting the holy life or spiritual life, thinking thus I shall end the old feelings, that is the pain or discomfort of hunger, without arousing new feelings, that is the pain or discomfort of overeating, and I shall be healthy and blameless and comfortable, live in comfort. Okay, so this is moderation in eating. And then we'll go on to the next quality. This is called wakefulness or vigilance. Vigilance means keeping awake And the Buddha explains the way the disciple who is engaged in intensive training maintains this wakefulness. Okay, during the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, the noble disciple purifies his mind of obstructive states. What are the obstructive states, especially in relation to meditation?
Exactly,
good. The five hindrances. What are the five hindrances? Can anybody enumerate them?
Sloth and torpor.
It's not enough to get them right. You also have to get them in the right order. You have to get them in the right order. You have to get them in the right order.
Sense or loss.
Okay, second. Oh, are you looking at the computer?
No, I'm writing question.
Oh, okay. Second. Shows where if one makes the right answer, it goes with a pleasant bang. But if you get the wrong answer, it goes okay. We have sensual desire, ill will,
sloth and torpor.
Okay, sloth and torpor,
restlessness and worry.
Yeah.
Doubt.
Okay, good. Bang. Come up for your prize. Okay, so these are the obstructive states, the five hindrances. And so notice the Buddha says in the directions, he says, walking back and forth and sitting. So even in the Buddha's time, this practice of walking meditation was done quite regularly. And so, even today, in countries like Sri Lanka, in the meditation monasteries, like the basic structure where the monk lives, it's called the kuti. Originally it meant a hut, but some of the huts can be not luxurious, but they be made out of stone, and with, you know, an inner chamber where the monk will sleep, maybe do his study or whatever. Sometimes they even have a latrine or toilet attached. But then each kuti will have what is called, in Pali would be a chakmana, but in Sinhala they call it a sakma, which means the word chakma means literally walking back and forth. But it's a kind of structure built outside the kuti for walking back and forth. Maybe we translate it as a walkway. If you go to Ranyan, or that's the forest monastery in Sri Lanka, you'll see the dwelling places of the monks are like this. This would be the kuti. So we'll have maybe a little toilet or latrine here, maybe a bed here. I'd have a little desk here with a chair, very simple. Maybe the entrance here, a little, maybe even a little veranda. Then, sometimes outside, sometimes it could be even attached. To the kuti, so that the entrance might be at one end of the stigma. So the sakman will be outside, often it's outside, under the trees, because it's a tropical climate, so you can have it all, use it all season, all year round, except for the rainy season, it's difficult. And then the sakman will be usually about 25, 30 paces long, and this will be made out of soil. There'll be like sometimes like a raised, slightly raised stone, a border around it. And at each end of the sakman, there'll be two stone slabs raised like seats, so that during the day, or even at night, if it's warm enough, one could sit on the sakman. You know, when you finish your walking meditation, then you could sit on the stone seat. You just take your cushion, put it on the seat, and then when you finish, do enough walking meditation, then one could do this period of sitting meditation, then when you finish the sitting, then you walk again. So you could do that just back and forth. Then if it gets too cool, then you go back into the kuti. And then when you want to go to sleep, you go into the kuti. And sometimes the kuti will have an attached walkway, even with a covering above it, so that one could do the walking meditation even during when it's raining, especially in some of the low country forest monasteries where there's a lot of rain. The kutis will have attached, covered walkways. Okay, so the monk does this walking back and forth and sitting during the day. Okay, then during the first watch of the night, sometimes people ask, what are the times of the first watch of the night? And you know, in the Buddha's day, they didn't have clocks or watches the way we do now. So what we can do is give an approximate answer. Could be from first watch, let us say, from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m., or maybe from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. He continues to do his walking meditation and sitting meditation. Then in the middle watch of the night, then again he lies down in the lion's posture, that is lying on the right side, one foot overlapping the other, mindful and alert, mindful and clearly comprehending. But actually, in my experience, you can't be too mindful or too alert, because then you won't fall asleep. You have to be willing to let the mind sort of drift off, otherwise you'll just be sitting there, lying there all night long, trying to go to sleep and wondering, why can't I fall asleep? Because you're too mindful. But one lies down, mindfully lying down, mindfully noting in the mind the time for waking up. So one makes the determination, if we have a clock to wake up, maybe 3 a.m. And when one is practicing diligent meditation, it's not too early. Okay, and then when one makes that determination, when the mind becomes really sharp, just you automatically wake up. You know, just as the clock is going 259, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, 55 seconds, 56, 57, 58, 59, 3 a.m., suddenly you wake up. I'm not that shocked yet. For me, wake up 3 a.m. What time is it? 5 a.m. How did I get here? Okay. So, maybe you're sleeping 10 a.m. Sorry, 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. That's the middle watch of the night. Then one wakes up at 3 a.m. Maybe washes, and then starts to resume the meditation in the last watch of the night, sitting, walking, maybe from 3 a.m., 3:15 a.m., till about 6:30 a.m. Again, walking back and forth, then sitting. And when one is practicing very diligently, the amount of sleep that one needs starts to go down. So normally we think, I need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And maybe some people's body is constituted that way. But often one finds when one is practicing very vigorously, if one is keeping the right balance between effort and tranquility, then because the mind is becoming calm and tranquil, that the amount of sleep that one needs becomes reduced. So that one could go from 7 or 8 hours to 6 hours, 5 hours, and when the meditation really becomes powerful, one could even go to 4 hours, 3 hours. Okay, maybe at this point then I'll pause and ask whether we have any questions on what I've covered so far. Okay, Tracy?
I have a question or an observation.
Yeah, maybe do we have the mobile microphone? Yeah, okay, that's it.
Press.
Yeah, there's something there to press.
Is it on?
Yeah, that's it.
The mind objects are considered sense objects.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really interesting to me because I think in the West, a lot of times we think that this path is about finding better thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a better thought to be attached to,
mm-hmm.
I'll really be on my way.
Have really.
And that if we find the right thought, that we'll be on the path to liberation.
Yeah, yeah.
But it really underscores the need to be wary of thinking itself or attachment to thought.
Yeah, so I should add to this that within the process of training, in certain types of meditation, one does use wholesome thoughts as a means to counteract and overcome unwholesome thoughts. For example, somebody has a lot of trouble with anger and ill will, so they will use the thought of connected with loving kindness. So thinking of different people, starting with oneself, a respected person, very close person, neutral people, hostile people. For each one thinks, may this person be well, may they be happy. And one uses that thought to try to bring up the wholesome feeling, or the good emotion that can counteract the ill will and anger. So we shouldn't just completely reject the role of thought. But of course, one doesn't become attached to the good thoughts, the wholesome thoughts. Any other questions?
One small question. Why does the Buddha always lie on his right side?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't actually know. It seems that the servant maybe...
The hat is on this side, so it'll be a right angle facing your hat.
You what?
The hat is on
the left, or it's on the left side. Yeah. So you raise the heart. Yeah, maybe it's just considered to have a certain like dignity to it. One doesn't find an explanation. It's just that
he's only eating in the morning.
Yeah.
Right. And so by the time he gets to, by the time that he's going to sleep, the food should have been long gone from the stomach, right?
Yeah.
Right. I suspect that has something to do with it.
Maybe if one understands those things about physiology, one could give a physiological explanation. But just as it's come down within the Buddhist tradition, it's just considered to be somewhat dignified to sleep on the right side. Do you have an explanation into Chinese Buddhism for that? Why the right side is used?
I was in a press conference once with the Dalai Lama as a reporter, and someone asked that, and he said he thought it had to do with circulation, perhaps, or a belief about circulation.
Perhaps,
but he wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. So you're in good company.
Yeah, well, if the Dalai Lama doesn't know. But they might have some explanation within the systems of what they call Ayurvedic medicine, which it's the medicine of both of India and Tibet and Sri Lanka. You know, it's the basically the Indian herbal medicine, which also has theories about the primary elements of the body, what they call the humors, bile. Everybody's supposed to be either of a bile, predominantly bile constitution, or phlegm constitution, or wind constitution. So maybe it's the right side that's believed to be most suitable for keeping the three humors in balance. But that's just a guess. Okay, let us see, maybe there are some questions coming from the internet. Okay, it seems that they're arranged in order. Okay, one question one here. What is the distinction between the Patimokkha and the Vinaya? The Vinaya is actually the full code of monastic discipline, whereas the Patimokkha is a selection of rules that's fixed in a particular pattern for observance by bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, monks and nuns. And Lavinia, we could say, has a broader scope than the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha are the basic rules which form the outline or the framework of the main part of the Vinaya. But the Vinaya contains not just the rules themselves, but it gives explanation of how the rules originated, sort of background story. It gives a word explanation, the meaning of each word in the rules, and it gives various cases in which some cases the rule actually applies, other cases it applies, but to a lesser degree. In other cases, it doesn't apply at all. And in addition to the Patimokkha and its detailed analysis, the Vinaya also contains a whole body of minor rules which are not in the Patimokkha, and also regulations for the Sangha that are not a matter of observance by individual monks, but regulations for the Sangha to observe together. For example, the rules or regulations for ordination, the regulations for observing the rains retreat, regulations for reciting the Patimokkha, regulations for penalizing a monk or a nun who violates some of the rules, and so on. So all of these are within the Vinaya, but not in the Patimokkha. Okay, so that is the distinction. Okay, second question. Could you break down the meaning in Pali of the expression indriya samvara? Okay, so the word indriya means the sense faculties. So the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind are called indriyas. The word indriya itself comes from the word indra. Indra in Vedic Brahmanism, Indra is the chief god, the chief of the gods. And so Indra has the role of governing the other gods. And so the sense faculty has the role of, you say, governing our experience through each of the senses. And so the sense faculty comes to be called indriya. Then the word samvara means, is what is translated as restraint. It means something like keeping guard over or preventing from flowing out. Keeping watch over, those are some of the implications of samvara. But it's best to translate it in restraint. Okay, that's the second question. Third question. Do the obstructive states refer to the five hindrances? You know, we already said that. I think that you must have written that question before we explained the obstructive states. After. So they didn't hear the explanation?
Maybe it's some emphasis.
Someone?
Maybe he missed that.
Okay.
I was debating should I write this question.
Okay.
After.
Okay, then the walk path is the word saktama. Saktama. Yeah, I'll just write that word. Lack of mindfulness. Chakma, Chakma. Okay, so those are the answers to all the questions. Any other questions? Okay, now we'll continue next week, next Saturday, same time. I want to ask, was everybody here, this is a little bit of a rhetorical question, was everybody here when I gave the class on the four jhanas? Would you want me to repeat the explanation of the jhanas? But for some, maybe it's a new explanation. If you weren't here for the explanation of the jhanas a few years ago, maybe raise your hands so that we should do it. Okay, we'll go over the jhanas again. What I'm going to do is to send to Kaiti, I have like a little table which gives the sort of analysis of the jhanas. So then she'll send it to you when she sends the announcement, or Sudama, when they send the announcement about the next class. And then you could print out that table, and then we'll go over the table to analyze the jhanas. Okay, so let us end. And then we'll have, after lunch today, maybe about 12 o'clock, 12:10, we could have a little discussion period if there are any other questions or points that you'd like to discuss. Okay, so let's end with the sharing of the merits. You can recite along. I think you will have the paper with the verses. Akasa taj pumata deva naga mahitika punyanta manamodipa chiranda kantu sasana. Akasa taj pumata deva naga mahitika punyanta manumodipa chiram rakantu desana akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta manumodipa chiram rakantu mamparam etavata chamhehi sampadam sampadam sabbe devam modantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutam modantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satana modantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavupadaya vichetato etantare satakale upapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanina Dukkha Pabuchantu Pusantu Nibhuti. Now we can all stand.
Okay, then we do three bows to the Buddha.
Out of bounds.